It's just before 4 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're celebrating 50 years of people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Coming up next weekend, All Things Considered, and at 5 o'clock, the recorded history of jazz with Paul Kivi. And 6 o'clock this evening, it is Jazz on America Avenue. John Sagari is your host. Tonight's weather, slight chance of showers, partly cloudy, lows in the mid-50s, and tomorrow mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s with light north wind. The Grand Rapids Tuesday Summer Concert Series continues at noon this Tuesday, August 11th. Four area singers present tunes from Broadway and beyond at First Lutheran Church. It is time now for All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
For KAXE News, I'm Emma Crabb with the Up North Report. Voters will decide Tuesday who will be the Democratic candidate for Minnesota's 8th Congressional District. Megan Buffington dug into the frontrunner's fundraising and shares what it tells us about their campaigns.
If big donors tell the whole story, then Trina Swanson will run away with the primary. A third of the former federal workers' donations have come from big contributors in the district, like a small business owner in Ely and a college lecturer in Nisswa. Swanson of Hermantown has raised $326,000 this year. That's significantly more than her biggest challenger, Luke Gulbronson. Since launching his campaign in April, the former reality TV personality from Eveleth has raised $201,000. Only $6,000 of that came from big donors in the district. But the two have received a similar amount in small donations. Only donors who have given more than $200 are reported to the Federal Election Commission. The rest of the individual donations are reported as a lump sum, without breaking down who or where they're from. Swanson says 85% of her campaign contributions have come from small donors in the district. She says most of her opponents have come from out of state. Gulbronson's campaign pushed back, saying he has a broad base of small, in-district, and Minnesotan donors. The candidates' donor lists reflect their unique backgrounds. Gulbronson's biggest donations have come from the East Coast, and his list is dotted with connections in the entertainment industry and his new career in luxury real estate. Swanson has received support from Washington, D.C. donors. She says those are connections from her 25 years in the federal government. Both are still way behind Republican Pete Stauber in fundraising. The incumbent representative raised $900,000 so far this year. But before the Dems can shift their focus to flipping a reliably red district, someone has to win the August 11th primary. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
All wildfire evacuation zones in St. Louis County have been lifted following an announcement from the sheriff's office. In a Facebook post Friday, the sheriff's office also stated it would reopen Echo Trail Road at 8 p.m. on Friday for all public travel. However, the office noted travelers may still experience delays on open roads as firefighting work remains ongoing. North Central Minnesota is experiencing a storage drought, and the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is urging people to be patient. Stella Meyerhoff has the story.
After a typical temporary drought, the rain comes back and water levels are replenished. Storage droughts are more persistent and can take years to reverse. Luigi Romolo is the DNR's Minnesota state climatologist. He says one season isn't going to get us out of this drought.
We're going to need to make up over a half a year of precipitation.
But there's good news.
In the long term, with the precipitation trend pointing towards increasing, as long as we practice good water conservation, we should be able to get out of this.
And if you're worried about your lawn, University of Minnesota Turf Grass Extension educator John Trappi has good news for you, too.
Most of the grasses that we grow in Minnesota are perfectly capable of going into what we call dormancy. Overall, most lawns can get a little bit brown or not be watered at all and be perfectly healthy.
Stella Meyerhoff, Report for America core member for KAXE News.
Tree damage from forest tent caterpillars is on the rise in Minnesota. The Department of Natural Resources stated in a news release Thursday that the caterpillars, also known as army worms, have damaged the leaves of over 60,000 acres of foliage in Aitkin and surrounding counties. This is already 19,000 more acres than the damage done throughout 2025. Leaf damage caused by the caterpillars won't kill a tree immediately. However, the DNR states that continuous feeding can kill off trees already stressed by factors like drought and disease. According to the DNR, periods of extreme forest tent caterpillar damage occur every 10 to 15 years. The last outbreak in 2023 consumed 1 million acres. The DNR states Minnesota is due for another outbreak and predicts destruction will continue to ramp up in 2027. That's it for the Up North report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Emma Crabb, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Hewlett.org.
Welcome to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. Iran said today that it will not negotiate directly with the United States as long as the U.S. is in violation of an agreement the two countries reached in June. And President Trump has told Axios that he is now, quote, low-keying it, only semi-negotiating with Iran. Meanwhile, Iran-backed Houthi rebels claimed responsibility today for an attack on an oil facility in southwestern Saudi Arabia. Iran and its allies, sometimes referred to as the Axis of Resistance, have succeeded in complicating the war. The Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Iran-backed Iraqi militias have remained resilient and dangerous, writes Peter Salisbury in a provocative Foreign Affairs magazine article this month. Salisbury teaches at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, and I call him up to ask how these groups are reshaping the war.
The Axis of Resistance is a network of non-state armed groups that Iran has been investing in for the last 20 to 40 years and has really built up the capacity of, to the extent that groups in Lebanon, Yemen, Iraq are all now launching drones, missiles at various adversaries, and in particular the Houthis. And the Iraqi groups are able to launch cross-border missile and drone attacks on Saudi Arabia and on commerce in the Red Sea in a way that has proved very difficult for the United States.
Is this a top-down structure, like with Tehran at the top, or how do power dynamics work within this?
Increasingly, these groups, while they're still very closely tied to Tehran, still very reliant on Iran, they have their own autonomous capabilities, their own supply lines, and have their own connections to one another and pool knowledge across what's less kind of a network and more an ecosystem. And that has allowed them, after a series of attacks by the United States and Israel over the past several years, to reconstitute themselves and continue to pose this kind of threat.
And describe the training of some of these groups and how involved Iran might be in that training.
So maybe 20, 25 years ago, Iran started really investing in training not just Hezbollah, who it's got this long-term investment in, and not just Hamas, which it had kind of this loose connection with throughout the 1990s, but really started building up a curriculum almost from basic military education up to higher education. So you can now be trained not just in basic military tactics, but in how to use relatively advanced drones and missiles, how to build them, including sending people off to technical training and even kind of higher institutes of learning in Iran, but also at training sites in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Yemen. They're not just sending them weapons and telling them which buttons to press.
On the note of weapons, you know, I'm curious, you know, how much of a role has the newer and cheaper technology that we've seen played, like the usage of drones in these groups' ability to wield power?
I mean, it's been transformative, frankly. Maybe 10, 15 years ago, the US and other Western powers were able to limit access to advanced weapons because they controlled most of the technology, most of the parts, what are known as intermediate goods that were flowing around the world. Fast forward a decade and a half, a lot of what goes into Houthi drones, Hezbollah drones, the Iranian drones as well, are manufactured very cheaply at large scale in China in particular. So the choke point for those goods has moved.
How do these particular groups obtain these parts? I mean, are they obtaining them directly from China?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, most of these groups now have their own fairly sophisticated international supply chains. They work with businessmen, with traders in China, across the world, in the Gulf to get things onto ships and either brought into ports or smuggled that kind of last mile into the territory they control. So again, fundamentally different than 10, 15, 20 years ago when most of what they got had to be shipped directly from Iran.
That's really interesting. How are the U.S. and its allies fighting these types of groups, knowing this type of power structure?
The assumptions behind Epic Fury and the assumptions behind things like the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign was that they were powerful enough and that enough of the capabilities, the needs of these groups were concentrated in specific places that they could simply kill the right number of people who had the knowledge needed to run these processes, blow up enough warehouses, manufacturing sites, along with doing all the things they've been doing to try and constrain their economies. And what they're learning now is that because the pool of knowledge needed to procure the parts, build the drones, get them up in the sky is actually sort of much more diffuse and distributed. The Israelis used to describe Iran and the Axis as an octopus with tentacles, which suggests this relatively simple, almost mechanistic structure. And really what you're dealing with something, it's like the difference between an old-fashioned telephone exchange where everything's routed through one site and the internet where everything kind of moves through 100 different places all at once before your data, your information gets to you.
So given how decentralized and diffuse this network is, what kind of new strategy might be needed for the U.S. and its allies?
It's going to be very difficult to uproot these groups because it's not just affecting conflicts in the Middle East. It's affecting conflicts all over the world, from Ukraine to Sudan to Ethiopia and beyond. And it's going to become an even bigger challenge for powerful states and for peace and security everywhere in the coming months, years, decades.
That is Peter Salisbury. He's a professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
What happens when you're washing your clothes or just trying to get a sip of water and the tap runs dry? Stay with us. In today's program, we'll hear from our reporter in Puerto Rico about the impact of water rationing there. First, though, we'll turn to NPR science correspondent Yuki Noguchi to talk to us about what has made this a record summer for foodborne illnesses. This week, confirmed cases of cyclosporiasis, which causes diarrhea, top 10,000. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have also traced several hundred cases of salmonella to Mexican jalapeno peppers. Yuki, these illnesses sound pretty worrisome. How bad is this year compared to others?
Well, you know, let's just start with the biggest outbreak, cyclospora. It shows up every summer, but this year may beat the previous case record by 10 to 20 fold. Now, this is a parasite that thrives in heat, and of course, it's been very hot. Mm-hmm. But another factor is mass production. And, you know, just the consolidation of the food business makes for mass outbreaks. The biggest cyclospora outbreak, you know, began with tainted iceberg lettuce from Taylor Farms in Mexico, which then traveled to Michigan and Ohio, including Taco Bell's and Walmart's. Those two states alone have confirmed 17,000 cases, many of which have yet to be reflected in the CDC's data. You know, so numbers here are undercounted and delayed. The salmonella bacteria outbreak is much smaller, 345 confirmed cases so far. But it's also widespread, you know, 27 states, again, because of national distribution in this case. Jalapenos grown in Sinaloa, Mexico, then brought to the U.S. by Coast Citrus distributors and served at popular restaurants like Chipotle and Qdoba, both of which have stop serving them.
So you mentioned that these cases are often undercounted. Do we know how, by how much?
You know, probably not. They often actually can't track the source of outbreaks either. It's just not easy to track because, you know, for example, diarrhea is common, you know, with cyclospora. It can take 2 weeks for symptoms to show. So you may not recall what you ate. You may not see your doctor and therefore never get tested. And most people, in fact, get better on their own anyway without an antibiotic. But, you know, this year's numbers, there's just new data challenges because the Trump administration slashed public health agencies and budgets last year, especially at the CDC and the Food and Drug Administration. And those fund state and local food safety programs. So for many states, those cuts are affecting the ground game against pathogens. And not only do they get less federal support, you know, in the form of surveillance or response coordination, they also have fewer staff, you know, to interview patients and investigate. Bob Custard, for example, is a sanitation and food safety consultant working with local governments in West Virginia, and he said this.
The system has been weakened. If you're not getting the reporting from the local level, it doesn't roll up to the state level and then roll up to the national level.
Yeah, so, you know, those delays are affecting the CDC's case numbers often by over a month.
So, Yuki, we do not know the scope of this, but what can consumers do to try and stay safe here?
Well, the key is hand washing, you know, and washing fresh produce.
Okay.
Both cyclospora and salmonella come from food or water contaminated with feces. So you can, you know, peel off the outer layer of lettuce and rinse the crevices of your berries. You know, remember that this year's big outbreaks involve big produce suppliers. So you might try buying from local, small suppliers, you know, farm markets, that kind of thing. But do not stop eating fresh produce. That's a concern because, you know, healthy foods help fight obesity and related conditions. And you don't want to trade one public health problem for another.
That was Yuki Noguchi, who covers science for NPR. Yuki, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Each morning on KEXE, you're invited to be part of a conversation. Conversation about people and the place we live.
Today, I'm joined by someone who was close with Cyrus One, Mitch Blessing. We talk about Cyrus's career in art and his legacy.
Cyrus Swan, who was he? He's a little kid from northern Minnesota, immensely talented, lived out in the woods, played in the woods, collecting rocks and sticks.
Time for a bright spot, a chance to highlight good things happening in northern Minnesota.
Today we are meeting a local athlete, high school senior Gabby Findey. She broke the all-time scoring record for Cass Lake Bina basketball. Keep the KEXE Morning Show conversations going with your support now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton with Jennifer Barr and Andrew DeZink.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is rejecting President Trump's 15-point roadmap for Gaza, saying Israeli forces will not withdraw until Hamas is fully disarmed. The U.S.-Iran war is not only sending gas prices higher, it's also affecting airline ticket prices. The travel site Kayak says an average domestic flight last week cost about $80 more than it did a year ago. The average international flight was about $170 more expensive than the same time last year. And in California, after a years-long fight, hundreds of thousands of rideshare drivers are set to form a union, giving them a place at the bargaining table with companies including Uber and Lyft. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation, collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. The U.S. territory of Puerto Rico is running out of water. The government there has begun rationing, cutting water to people's homes on a rotating schedule. Reservoirs are running dry amid a drought. But water infrastructure on the Caribbean island has also been deteriorating for decades. NPR's Adrian Florido takes us there.
In the center of the capital, San Juan, Sonia Palacios lives in one of the many neighborhoods in Puerto Rico where running water is no longer a sure thing. Her apartment's on the ground floor of a three-story building.
Do you have water right now?
I'll show you.
She walks to a faucet on the side of her apartment and turns the knob.
Nothing.
Not a drop.
Not a drop.
Not a drop.
Although Puerto Rico officially began rationing water last week, many people, like Palacios, have been coping with dry taps for months now. Sometimes she gets water for a full day or two, sometimes just for an hour, often not a drop for days, with no warning or explanation from the public water utility.
So you get paralyzed because you cannot begin laundry, because what happens if you are washing your clothes and the water ends? What do you do with all that clothes on that machine with soap? What do you do with that?
She limits her showers. She uses paper towels to clean her dishes. She uses buckets and bins to store water whenever she can fill them. And she shows me all the empty gallons of water she's had to buy for drinking.
But why do I have to be buying water from the supermarket when I am supposed to be drinking water from the faucet? How come I have to do that?
The 180,000 homes and businesses now affected by the government's new rationing plan will lose their running water between 3 and 4 days a week. On television, the governor, Jennifer Gonzalez-Colon, said the cuts will continue until there's enough rain to replenish the island's reservoirs, which have run dangerously low amid Puerto Rico's driest summer in more than a century. We're facing a reality that's not within our control, the governor said. It's not raining. It's an explanation that many people here are not buying because the problems started months before the drought.
Agua para el pueblo! Agua para el pueblo!
People have been calling on the governor and the president of the island's public water utility to resign. They think they're mismanaging and further compromising the island's already fragile water system. Alfredo Cuyar said the drought is a problem, but not the only reason people don't have water.
People are suffering in Puerto Rico because of the poor management, ineptitude, and incompetence.
Cuyar leads a coalition of citizens who think the problems began when the governor fired longtime leaders of the water utility and installed people who didn't know how to operate the old and complex network of pipes and valves.
All of the experience, knowledge, expertise went out the door. And, well, we've been in a crisis ever since. For 30 months, we've been under crisis.
The governor's office did not respond to a request for comment about this accusation, but she and the head of the utility have publicly said they have things under control and are working to improve the system. But by the government's own admission, the water system is in bad shape. A government report found that more than 60% of Puerto Rico's clean water is lost through leaky pipes before it ever reaches people's homes. In the community of Rio Piedras, Noemi Davis is scraping debris away from a little broken pipe in front of the abandoned house next door. It's been leaking for more than a year.
So many people suffering the lack of water, and to see this water just wasting over here is frustrating. It's clean water that some people don't have for many days.
She says she's been pleading with the water utility, but no one's ever come to fix it. Her husband, Reynaldo Velasquez, says, look around. These sorts of leaks are everywhere. And he's right.
Maybe you'll see, well, it's just a little water coming out, but
you multiply that by the thousands coming out in Puerto Rico, then it's going to add up to the problem. So, yeah, we need to fix it.
There will be no quick fix to Puerto Rico's crumbling water system. And because there's not much rain in the forecast, many here are worried about how long the water restrictions will last. Adrian Florido, NPR News, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
During World War II, the Nazis looted more than 600,000 works of art, mostly owned by Jews. In the decades since, there's been an effort to get these works back to their owners, but it's not easy, and roughly a fifth of them have still not been returned. Now a new AI chatbot might be making that complicated process a little simpler, NPR's Chloe Veltman reports.
Some Jewish families and institutions know that art may have been taken from them during World War II, but reclaiming it is often a long and fraught process.
There's no central repository, no database that's telling you where that art is.
Joel Greenberg is the founder of Art Ashes. The nonprofit helps families track down and recover Nazi-looted art. Greenberg says on top of locating the missing art, the rightful owners need to prove it was stolen from them in the first place.
And then to recreate the historical record of what actually happened to the family and the family's art is also very difficult because those records, if they exist, are spread among different repositories around the world.
There are dozens of archives containing records of these missing artworks in a variety of languages and formats.
If you could create a system that could scan all the databases that have the Nazi looted art records, that would be very, very useful.
A team at Santa Clara University in Silicon Valley is aspiring to do just that.
We are applying AI tools to make it easier to make the kinds of connections that seasoned researchers would have to spend a long time having to do manually.
This is Michael Santoro. The business school professor says his team's new chatbot, the AI Provenance Assistant, is testing how artificial intelligence could eventually make it easier for people to search archives of stolen art. Right now, Santoro says the tool is only scraping records from one database, that of the Jeu de Paume Museum in Paris. The Nazis warehoused tens of thousands of looted artworks and other cultural objects at the museum during the war and kept elaborate records, records that are now available for anyone to search online. But Santoro says his AI tool is more intuitive because it does not require users to deal with drop-down menus and input keywords into boxes.
By enabling ordinary language queries to be made of art databases.
By ordinary language, Santoro means you can type a question using everyday words into the chatbot's interface online. For example, what artworks belong to Hugo Simon? And the bot will bring up a list of more than 70 belonging to the late Jewish banker and art collector, including stolen works by Picasso and Canaletto.
This project shows promise.
Carla Chaprow teaches cultural property law at the University of California, Berkeley. She says tools like the AI Provenance Assistant will be more useful when they encompass many databases, not just one. Chaprow also says these chatbots should link to digitized copies of the original archival records, such as confiscation and claim files, since the answers provided by AI and the underlying database are susceptible to errors.
It's all speculative if you can't look at the evidence, and the evidence is in the primary sources.
Some people who specialize in tracking down looted artworks from World War II, like Mark Mazurovsky, are less optimistic about AI's potential to streamline his field of expertise.
People find looted art without resorting to AI.
Mazurovsky is a co-founder of the Holocaust Art Restitution Project. He says many archives remain undigitized and are subject to data privacy laws. This drastically limits the pool of data an AI tool can scrape.
Even if they are published on the internet, how are you going to interpret all that alphabet soup? These are really complex cases.
Meanwhile, the team behind the AI Provenance Assistant at Santa Clara University say they plan to expand their tool to include more databases. They also hope, down the road, to apply AI to finding and repatriating African, Asian and pre-Columbian art as well. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Next month will mark 30 years of the death of a rap legend. In September of 1996, Tupac Shakur died following a drive-by shooting near the Las Vegas Strip. For decades, the mystery of who was behind his killing plagued the public, but no one had ever been charged. That is, until just a few years ago. In 2023, police charged Dwayne Davis, also known as Keefe D, with organizing Shakur's murder. The trial begins tomorrow. Joining us now is journalist Ben Westhoff. He's also the author of Original Gangsters, where he writes about the Tupac Shakur murder investigation. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's be specific here. Davis is not charged with pulling the trigger. The actual person police suspected as the gunman, Orlando Anderson, was killed in an unrelated shooting in 1998. So what exactly is Dwayne Davis charged with here?
He's charged with providing the murder weapon and basically orchestrating the killing.
And bring us back to that night in Las Vegas when Tupac Shakur was killed. Who was involved? What was happening?
Tupac was in Las Vegas for the Mike Tyson fight, actually. And so after the fight, Tupac and his group got into an altercation with a guy named Baby Lane, who was a member of the Southside Crips from Compton, and they got in a fight, and Tupac is actually seen on camera stomping this guy and beating him. And it wasn't too much longer after that when this group of people affiliated with the guy who got stomped allegedly came and killed him right on the Las Vegas Strip.
And now Dwayne Davis has been arrested for this. What led to Dwayne Davis's arrest and now the trial?
Well, he has kind of been talking about this case for a long time, and he was originally charged with drug dealing with PCP-related charges, and so as part of a plea bargain, he talked to a LAPD cop named Greg Kading and basically laid out what actually happened, according to him, and you know said he didn't pull the trigger himself, but his nephew did, the one who got stomped. Keefe D also later published a book seemingly admitting to the crimes.
So he actually wrote a book in which he said, hey, I did this?
Well, it was kind of in the OJ style, you know, sort of thing, except that it was very self-incriminating, but the defense is now arguing that since he had a co-author for the book, it can't always be clear if it's him talking or the co-author talking.
Is this a slam dunk case in your mind?
I think so. I mean, we've known about these details for so long. He seems to have admitted so much of it that I would think so. The only aspect is that a lot of what he's being charged with can't really be corroborated otherwise. There were three other men with him in the car that night. But all three of them are dead. And so it's just sort of his own story is all we really have to go on.
And he, of course, is facing life in prison if convicted. What have we heard from people who were close to Tupac Shakur, his friends, his family?
I think the main thing we've heard is why have we not had resolution in this case?
Right.
It's been 30 years, and it's not like there haven't been leads. There have been, in fact, you know, multiple LAPD investigations.
So after his death, Tupac Shakur became sort of a mythical figure in many ways. You know, there's so many theories about his killing. Some even believe that he was still alive. Why do you think his story became such a kind of a pop culture legend?
Tupac really captured, you know, not just the zeitgeist of his time. He was really popular while he was alive, but in death, he almost became more popular, and not just as a musician and not even really just as a cultural figure, but as a sort of almost political prophet. You know, his words, his lyrics, and also the things that he said in interviews still resonate today. He was very much for, you know, empowerment for African-American people, and a lot of what he said kind of predicted the Black Lives Matter movement in a way.
That is Ben Westhoff, a journalist and author of Original Gangsters. He's been speaking about the Tupac Shakur trial that begins tomorrow. Thanks.
Great to talk with you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. Have you ever had an awkward moment? Let's be real. Who hasn't? I mean, I might be having one right now. Awkward. Anyway, turns out embracing awkwardness can be a good thing. Here's Andy Tagle from NPR's Life Kit.
If you're often visited by the ghosts of humiliation's past, maybe when you're just trying to sleep or when a familiar song comes on, it might help to know that there's an actual term people use for these mental intruders: cringe attacks. These flashbacks might feel random, but
a time that you were really, really afraid or really angry, anything that's like emotionally heightened is going to stick in our brains.
Melissa Dahl is a writer and the author of Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. The thing about embarrassment, she says, it's not universal. It's relative, uniquely formed by our culture, our social context, and our sense of self to help guide us back to the safety of our clans. So you might look at these memories as alarm bells. Remember, stick with the group. Don't stray too far from the cave.
And if you were cast out, you would be like, you know, eaten by a saber-toothed tiger or something like that. And it's always treated as if that doesn't apply to today.
But we all know there can still be real consequences when we don't follow social norms.
Isolation and loneliness is incredibly damaging. We still depend on social connection for our health and well-being and just general happiness.
So embarrassment is a pro-social tendency that can be positive in a lot of ways. For example, one study out of UC Berkeley from 2011 suggested that people who were more easily embarrassed were seen as more trustworthy and more generous than their less easily embarrassed counterparts. But of course, that doesn't help how much embarrassment can sting in the moment. So what can you do about it? One thing to remember is that your self-conscious feelings aren't always accurate. Take this famous study out of Cornell that Dahl told me about, on something called the spotlight effect.
And it's basically like, we assume more people are paying attention to our faults and our embarrassing missteps than they are.
So in this study, researchers put a bunch of participants in a room and then had one person show up 5 minutes later.
And they made them wear a really silly t-shirt.
Really silly. It featured a large picture of Barry Manilow.
Afterwards, they asked them, okay, how many people do you think will remember that you're wearing this ridiculous t-shirt?
T-shirt wearing participants guessed that number would be about half. In reality, less than a quarter remembered who was on the shirt.
Which kind of cracks me up because the advice typically goes like, oh, like no one's paying attention to you anyway. And like, that's not actually what the study found. Like some people are, just not as many people as we think.
So relax. Even if you showed up to that meeting with a rip in your pants, chances are most of the people in the room didn't notice or didn't mind. If you're frequented by the same intense, embarrassing memories, there are some other things you can try to soften the edges a bit. One study showed that if you can shift your focus to other details surrounding a cringe attack, like what furniture was in the room at the time, you might be able to lessen the strength of the emotion tied to that memory. But you could also just, you know, try giving yourself a break or maybe even a pat on the back.
Thank God I'm cringing over my past self, because that suggests some personal growth, hopefully.
Dahl says the more you can lighten up and laugh it off, the better. Because embarrassment can be isolating, but it doesn't have to be.
These feelings are just so wrapped up in empathy and connectedness. Even if it's horrible in the moment, you just have to remember that, like, it's going to make a really good story eventually.
For NPR's Life Kit, I'm Andy Tagle.
You can find more tips and life hacks at npr.org/lifekit. This is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. At 5 o'clock, the recorded history of jazz with volunteer Paul Kivi, and 6 o'clock, jazz on America Avenue with your volunteer host, John Sigari. Support comes from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com, member FDIC. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy, lows in the mid-50s, slight chance of showers and light north wind, and tomorrow mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s. Looking ahead to Tuesday, mostly sunny and highs again in the mid to upper 70s. You can try out the sport of lacrosse with the Grand Rapids Amateur Lacrosse Association this Tuesday, 5:30 to 7 at the Nashwauk Township Fields. Wear athletic clothing and bring your own water. We continue with All Things Considered on KAXE.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Iran says it won't negotiate directly with the U.S. as long as the U.S. is what it considers to be in violation of an agreement the two countries reached in June that called for limits on Tehran's nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. Russia and Ukraine carried out a series of airstrikes that left civilians in both countries dead. The two sides have extensive air power but aren't as strong when it comes to defenses. And at the weekend box office, Spider-Man: Brand New Day took the top spot with an estimated $144 million in its second weekend. The Sony Marvel film has made $1.6 billion globally in just 10 days of release, putting it on track to be being among the biggest blockbusters ever. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from the Andrew Carnegie Foundation, formerly Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. Today is the end of a week-long annual celebration by Grateful Dead fans known as the Days Between. That's between the date of Jerry Garcia's birthday and the date of his death in August 1995. And we have with us here in the studio Felix Contreras, wearing, of course, a tie-dye shirt. He's one of several very dedicated deadheads here at NPR. Felix, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
So tell us why this summer, the Days Between celebration, was just a little bit different.
Okay, it's the first time in 61 years that there are no summer tours by any of the principal original members. And it's especially noteworthy after the passing of Bob Weir, who was one of those original members, in January of this year. So my NPR music colleague and I, Isabel Gomez Sarmiento and I, decided to hit the road to take stock of the band's legacy. Early in the summer, we went to Monte Rio, California for a festival headlined by Graham Lesh, who is the son of original member Phil Lesh, playing Grateful Dead music in a small amphitheater along the Russian River in Northern California. That's the band playing Touch of Grey, Graham Lesh and friends playing Touch of Grey. You know, we were surrounded by tons of folks that were just so excited about keeping the Grateful Dead style of music alive, and most of all, the community of fans to keep it going. All of this in the shade of beautiful redwood trees.
Felix, this is, how did you get this assignment? This is awesome. So as part of your reporting, you did a call out to listeners to learn how they became deadheads. And I'm just curious, what did you hear?
You know, we heard from people from all walks of life, from farmers to West Point graduates. And the answers reflected that variety of personal connection to the band's songbook. Everybody has a different story.
Right.
Here's Gia Pisto, who sent us this from Columbia, Missouri.
My sister was actually a big fan of the Grateful Dead in the early 90s. And when she died in 2011, we gathered and we sang Broke Down Palace in her memory. And I can't really speak the words to fully describe what I feel when I listen to the Dead or even see a bumper sticker on a fellow fan's car, but I can say that I feel my sister.
Very emotional connections coming from Gio Pisto.
Yeah.
Well, listener Jim Labrie showed how a random guy sitting next to him at a concert helped him see the light.
The Dead began playing He's Gone, but I was confused by the song being played at a much slower tempo. I quickly asked my new friend, why are they playing it so slowly? He sort of half smiled and looked at me and said, are you in a hurry? Right then, I was hooked.
Broke Down Palace, He's Gone. Those are two of my favorite Dead songs. I mean, the band, of course, has an incredible musical legacy, but they were also influential in sort of non-musical ways. What did you discover about that?
You know, one of the stops we made was to the library at the University of California, Santa Cruz, which holds the band's papers. And I'm using air quotes on that, okay?
Their papers.
Because the band left a visual bread trail of things like the newsletters they sent to fans in the early 70s. They also created a ticket agency. They sold their own tickets, and the fans sent in elaborately designed envelopes along with their money orders for tickets. Those are also in the collection, which also includes the mid-60s early psychedelic concert posters, which reflect a major countercultural artistic shift that the band was part of back then.
I mean, those posters are a legend. I mean, I hear there's also a vault of recordings somewhere, right?
The band, check this out, the band recorded just about every single concert they ever played in the 30 years before Jerry Garcia died. And all of those recordings, plus tape of their studio albums, unreleased tracks, other recorded music, is in a vault administered by Rhino Entertainment. And once a year, they release an elaborately designed multi-CD box set featuring specific tours, venues, cities, or shows. And what we're hearing right now is from the iconic May 8th, 1977 show in Barton Hall on the Cornell campus, 5877. That recording, by the way, was added to the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress in 2012. They say that they accepted it because of its cultural and historical significance.
Amazing. I mean, we mentioned earlier that your goal was to learn who and what will carry the band's legacy. What conclusion did you and Isabella land on there?
You know, we kept coming across the idea and the fact that the music will survive in as many different ways as there are people who will listen, whether by Grateful Dead cover bands or other groups in the jam band scene. But what pulls all this together is the community created when you're in a crowd listening to Grateful Dead songs. And that's, this band creates a camaraderie unlike any I've ever experienced. It's really about shared ethos, shared history, and the songs.
If my words did glow with the gold of sunshine.
There are lessons in the lyrics that are both celebrations and meditations, like in this song, like Ripple, which you're hearing now, which is full of beautiful poetry. And that wordless chorus at the end creates community the moment you sing along with it, whether in a stadium full of other true believers or at an open mic in a local cafe.
That is one of my favorites. That was NPR's Felix Contreras, host of Alt Latino. Felix, thank you.
Thanks for having me, man.
The biggest movie of the summer is undoubtedly Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey.
Remember, a wife, a son.
Now, The Odyssey has garnered acclaim from both fans and critics and is on track to becoming one of the biggest box office hits of Nolan's career. His last film, the three-hour biopic Oppenheimer, won 7 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director.
We're in a race against the Nazis, and I know what it means if the Nazis have a bomb.
I think we all know what that means. This is many of us asking, just how good is Christopher Nolan? Does his name belong among the greatest film directors of all time? Well, I'm going to pose these questions to a Nolan fan, all things considered producer Mark Rivers, who produces our Cineplexity segment, and a not-so-great fan of Mr. Nolan, NPR science editor and correspondent Jeff Brumfield. Hello to you both.
Hey, Rob.
Hi, Rob.
Okay, I'm just going to get this out of the way. Is Christopher Nolan overrated? Is he underrated? Is he mid?
I think he's right in the middle. Maybe not. I wouldn't say mid. I'd say properly rated. I mean, listen, I don't think even Nolan would say that he is above reproach. But I would say that he is the preeminent filmmaker of our generation, or of this generation. He is the filmmaker who matters the most to the movies as an event, as a communal experience, as a popular art form to be debated and enjoyed. When the industry is facing such existential threats, Nolan is kind of the ambassador for the movie still mattering.
Mark Rivers coming hot out the gate. Jeff, I feel like you may have a differing
take. Just sighing already. He's
like, 30 years from now, no one will care about Christopher Nolan.
Wow.
He has no staying power. He's of this moment.
HR.
He may be
HR.
The best we can do, which is a sad commentary on the state of Hollywood. the best a male director can do right now. But nah,
Jeff,
he's no good.
I want you to back that opinion up.
Well, I can't. I can't back that up.
No, he can't because he's not correct.
Wow. This is already getting heated in here. So I'm just going to interrupt this with, I'd like to talk about his latest film, The Odyssey. Where does this film rank in his sort of filmography for you, Mark?
The Odyssey is kind of in the middle tier of his films for me.
Okay.
I think in these really puny times on screen, like anything that, with this kind of spectacle kind of deserves to be seen. But I feel like what happens when a film this big is that the flaws of a filmmaker are rendered just as big. So, you know, people have talked about his problems writing female characters. I think sometimes he doesn't let his scenes, like, breathe. They can feel very crowded and rest, like he's kind of smothering the scene with score, with the way that the pace of the editing. He makes you feel the physical sensations of a scene, right? Like, you feel like you're on the ship with Odysseus as the storms are rocking his ship, right? You can you feel like you're in the Trojan horse with his soldiers. Nolan's good at making you feel the physical sensations of a sequence, but he's not as good at making you feel the emotional stakes or emotional sensations of
a scene. I would agree with you on that, Mark. So I saw this film yesterday, and I honestly thought it was stunning. I saw it in an IMAX theater. Mm-hmm. And you felt what everyone on the screen was feeling. You know, the score was incredible. But again,
the score is score.
Much like many of Nolan's films, I feel like a lot of his films drown in their scores. But I digress. Jeff, I want to go back to you here, and I'm sure you're going to give us even more hate.
So I thought it was, like, the most typical of Nolan, all right, and a real disservice to The Odyssey. I mean, the Mediterranean, for those of us who have visited, and for those of us who have sort of some, I would say, cultural ties to it, it's a lively place. It's a place full of emotion and color and beauty.
And Cyclops.
And The Odyssey was drab. I mean, it could have been like the Hebrides, you know, those islands on the northern edge of England. You know, it was drab and colorless. The Sirens, the most alluring song that is supposed to exist on Earth, was rendered by Christopher Nolan as sad clarinets and Matt Damon screaming.
So, Jeff, I'm going to turn to you because you came out of the gates kind of raging against Christopher Nolan.
Ranting and raving.
Is there a single Nolan film that you think is okay?
Yeah, I mean, one of his first, his breakout movie, Memento, which was about this guy who had, like, amnesia. He couldn't remember anything, and the whole movie was him trying to figure out what was going on.
It's my memory.
Amnesia.
No. It's different from that. I have no short-term memory. I know who I am. I know all about myself. I just, since my injury, I can't make new memories. Everything fades.
Memento was revolutionary in a lot of ways, right? I mean, it really introduced sort of this asynchronous storytelling, and it's a great movie.
You won't hear me argue about Memento. What does Nolan do in that film well, in your opinion?
I think for me, it was the first time seeing Nolan doing his tricks, but he has really basically been doing the same tricks ever since, so it gets a little tedious after a while. And I think the fact it was a mystery, you know, it was sort of, it unraveled and delivered on the promise of, like, you were going to learn what happened to this guy. And it was small, you know.
It was very intimate
in a way that future Nolan movies have not been.
So, Mark, what are your top three Nolan films?
All right, so top three, going backwards, three, Memento, two, The Dark Knight.
And why do you want to kill me?
I don't want to kill you. What would I do without you?
And go one, back. Oppenheimer.
Really like Oppenheimer?
I think Oppenheimer has some of the issues that The Odyssey has, but it works more. I think so. This is the story about the so-called father of the atomic bomb, right? And I think there's a really kind of, like, intricate web of, like, consequence going on in this movie. The way power shifts. Like, in this film, power looks like the Trinity test, but power also looks like the army general deciding not to bomb Kyoto because he and his wife vacation there. I think Oppenheimer doesn't get enough credit for just how, like, intricate that movie is and all the things that it's, like, juggling and exploring.
Okay, so you're hitting on something that he does well. Anything else for either of you that you think that Nolan does well that is sort of a hallmark thing that would, which is why people enjoy his films?
Go ahead, Mark.
I mean, I think this is a guy, I mean, so one of the critiques we've kind of mentioned is maybe he doesn't know how to write female characters well, which I think in some cases can be fair. I don't know if he knows how to write male characters that well. I don't really go to Nolan
maybe it's not about
for
the characters.
You know, I think Nolan has really cool movie ideas, not necessarily people ideas. Right. So, you know, in Inception, a 2010 film.
I specialize in a very specific type of security. Subconscious security.
You're talking about dreams.
You know, he builds this rotating hallway during like one fight. That's pretty cool. Or the truck flip in The Dark Knight. Or, you know, what if, you know, in Dunkirk, his film about the Dunkirk evacuation in World War II.
Right. You can practically see it from here.
What?
Home.
What if these different lines of action were happening on in different timelines or different time frames? So I go for, like, what is he going to show me? I don't really go for what is he going to reveal to me about the human experience.
I agree. I think he does a good action sequence, a good sequence in general. Like,
set pieces. Yeah. I'll also say I think he's really gotten at something about the way men, particularly white men, can kind of take what's going on in their head and, like, impose it upon the rest of the world without thinking about the consequences of this. That applies to Batman, that applies to Oppenheimer, that applies to Insomnia, a very unappreciated film from 2002. You know, these men are saying, I'm going to live in my own reality or kind of create my own reality, take what facts that will work for me, and forget the rest.
That actually gets at the core of kind of what I find annoying about Christopher Nolan. I do think he is a man director for men. But I think he's got one sort of note, which is a note that really has resonated in this era, which is like men not understanding how they fit in the kind of post, you know, feminist era. And so he has a lot, all his characters are the same character, the masculine, violent man who doesn't know how to fit into the world. And I find it so boring.
So here's an idea. I mean, is there anything that either of you want to see from Nolan in his future work?
Jeff?
Woman lead. Let's just have him do a movie with all women.
Just to see if he can handle it.
Why not?
You know, I kind of similar to that. I would love to see him work with a female screenwriter, or maybe just another screenwriter, and it's just to see how that might rein him in or like temper his approach. I would love to see that, and also maybe half the budget of the Odyssey, maybe even a third of the budget of the Odyssey. Like let's impose some financial constraints on him and see what he does with that.
That shouldn't be difficult. That was NPR's Mark Rivers and Jeff Brumfield. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all from us tonight. We're going to go out on Broke Down Palace, my own personal favorite Grateful Dead song. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered, and what a long, strange trip it has been.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Schwab, offering the Schwab Teen Investor Account, where teens can gain hands-on investing experience. It's co-owned by parents and teens, so parents can monitor the account while teens learn how to invest. More at schwab.com. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, for 35 years, sharing what works in schools today and working to inspire new ways to learn tomorrow. More at edutopia.org.